Well, thank you, Gary, for that wonderful introduction. The history of endocrinology, I think, uniquely informs us in how we got to where we are today. All the sessions that are happening outside this room had a basis from our past. Maybe it's because I've transitioned to that old age group myself, but I've come to appreciate and actually treasure the history of endocrinology. This is a spectacular Endo 2017, but in this room, in Chapin Theater, we've hit the pause button for 45 minutes, and we're going to look back. With regard to this presentation, I have no relevant financial relationships to disclose, and I'll not be discussing off-label drug usage. Except, in the 1940s, everything was off-label, right? So that's the one proviso. I have three slides to document the source materials I've used for this presentation. First is Edward Kendall's autobiography, Cortisone, Memoirs of a Hormone Hunter. This was published in 1971. Second, Dwight Engel. Dwight Engel is a close colleague of Kendall, and he's actually the one that developed the bioassay for glucocorticoid effect. And after Kendall died, he was asked by the National Academy of Sciences to write a biographical memoir. So this is, we're looking at one row of the Mayo Archives of Medical Records. Everyone in their family seems to have a hoarder, you know, someone that just saves everything. It stacks up in the basement and all their rooms. Well, Mayo Clinic is that version of your Aunt Tilly that hoards everything. Mayo Clinic saves everything. So in this building's square footage, it's about the size of a soccer field, two stories tall, and floor-to-ceiling medical records. We had a unified medical record from about 1901 to 1996. 1996, we went to electronic medical record. But all the original records are saved. They've never been disposed of. They've never been put on microfiche. And they're all in these rows. And you can see how long these rows are. That's a person standing way back there. And some of you that are closer to the screen may actually be able to identify the individual in the foreground. This is actually a visiting professor endocrinologist from the UK. And I took her over there during her visit just to document this history. So I could go back and look at the medical records of the first patients treated with cortisone. And this is the medical record of the very first patient. We're going to talk a lot about her during this presentation. Also, we have a history of medicine library within which, again, Mayo saves everything. We have all of Edward Kendall's lab books, and I've reviewed those for this presentation. I've reviewed the pertinent medical literature and the pertinent lay press. The story starts with the chemist, Edward Calvin Kendall. He's born in 1886, South Norwalk, Connecticut. He developed a keen interest in chemistry during high school and completed his undergraduate degree in chemistry at Columbia, where he also received his MS degree in biochemistry and his PhD in chemistry. He was appointed to his first job, September 1st, 1910, in a chemical laboratory at Park Davis & Company on a salary of $1,350 per year. He was assigned to isolate the hormone from the thyroid gland. He was disappointed by the intellectual isolation, and he resigned from Park Davis after 5 months. He returned to New York City to head up a lab at St. Luke's Hospital, which was a Columbia affiliate. Kendall's lab was in this addition building next to the hospital on the third floor. By 1913, he had purified the active principle in the thyroid 100-fold, and he proved biologic activity in patients with hypothyroidism, shown over on the right, this one with hypothyroidism, and treated with Kendall's extract created euthyroidism. However, he felt his research progress was underappreciated at St. Luke's. The hospital administrator at St. Luke's sent Kendall a box of breakfast cereal, with a letter directing him to analyze the cereal. Kendall later wrote, "I threw the letter and cereal into the wastebasket." The final decisive incident was that my salary for 1914 would be the same as it had been in 1913. And so ended my efforts to carry out research in a biochemistry in an institution that was not interested in research. So what happens next? A friend arranged an interview at the Rockefeller Institute with Dr. Simon Flexner. Kendall shared his progress on thyroid extracts and treatment of hypothyroidism. He was very proud of the rapid progress he had made. However, Flexner was not impressed and said, "Young man, it is not easy to get into Rockefeller Institute. When we want to have someone come with us, we will do whatever is necessary to get him. But otherwise, it's not possible to join this institute." Kendall later wrote, "I did not like what Dr. Flexner said, and I disliked the way he said it." Neither realized at the time, but their paths would cross again just 3 years later. Colleagues told him that the Mayo brothers had a keen interest in the thyroid. Here's an article from Charlie Mayo from 1913, observations on 5,000 thyroid operations. So Kendall went to Rochester, Minnesota. He interviewed, and he promptly joined the Mayo Clinic staff on February 1st, 1914. Kendall's lab was on the fourth floor of what then was the brand new Mayo Clinic building, called the 1914 building. Here's a photograph of that original laboratory. In an effort to isolate the active principle from the thyroid, Kendall used 6,500 pounds of hog thyroid glands. On Christmas Day, 1914, Kendall succeeded in isolating pure crystalline thyroxin. At the 1916 FASEP meeting, Kendall presented his paper, "Isolation in Crystalline Form of the Iodine-Containing Compound of the Thyroid Gland." The meeting was held in New York City. The chair of the meeting and session was Dr. Simon Flexner. Some days are just really good days. Kendall gave away the patent rights to thyroid hormone to prevent private manufacturers and dealers from exploiting my invention in order that my invention may accrue to the benefit of the medical profession and the public, to hereby sell, assign, and transfer onto the University of Minnesota in consideration of the sum of $1. Times have changed. His success in 1914 with isolating thyroid hormone provided the focus for his career. Called Nick by his close friends and by his wife, the chief by some of his lab associates, and most commonly Dr. Kendall by others, Edward Calvin Kendall was a self-described hormone hunter. He once said, "I want to grow a great big oak tree. I'm not interested in a bunch of blackberry bushes." So we're going to fast forward to 1925. Dr. Leonard Rountree, a clinical scientist at Mayo Clinic, and he was the Endocrine Society president in 1924, was treating the uniformly fatal condition of Addison's disease, primary adrenal failure, with what was called the Muirhead regimen. The Muirhead regimen involved injections of epinephrine, epinephrine suppositories 3 times per day, and ingesting raw cow adrenal glands with each meal. This was the first treatment program to prolong the life of a patient with Addison's disease. Up to that point, it was uniformly fatal. In 1929, Dr. Piffner from Princeton came to Mayo Clinic to discuss his bovine adrenal extract that kept adrenalectomized cats alive. Piffner and Swingle published their findings in Science in 1930. However, they had not tested it in humans because they lacked a medical school and a research hospital. So in 1930, Rountree described the first human with Addison's disease to be treated with the Swingle-Pifner extract, and it worked. It saved the patient's life. However, it was complicated by injection site reactions that were quite limiting. So Rountree went to Kendall. Kendall was president of the Endocrine Society in 1930. He asked Kendall to prepare better adrenal extracts so that they wouldn't have this issue with local injection site reactions. The chief took on the project, but with a great big oak tree in mind. During his experiments, the cost of bovine adrenals rose from 20 cents a pound to $3 a pound. That would be $42 a pound in today's dollars. In 1934, he struck a deal with Park Davis. He would extract adrenaline. Park Davis was the major producer of adrenaline in the U.S. Kendall would extract adrenaline at no cost to Park Davis if Park Davis could supply him with 600 pounds of bovine adrenals each week. He could then use the cortex for the studies he wanted to perform to determine the active principle from the adrenal cortex. He then struck a side deal with a separate company, Wilson Labs, for an additional 300 pounds of bovine adrenals per week. And for them, he produced a crude adrenal extract, but then he could use the adrenal medullas from that deal to increase his production of epinephrine. He was pretty ingenious. From 1934 to 1949, virtually all of the adrenaline used in North America was manufactured in the little town of Rochester, Minnesota, at Mayo Clinic. This lab ran 24 hours a day in three shifts. By 1949, over 150 tons of adrenal glands had been processed at Mayo Clinic. In terms of research supply dollars, $12.4 million. 1934, Kendall recognized that the adrenal cortex produced more than one hormone. And over that next year, he and his group isolated five crystalline compounds. They labeled them by letters of the alphabet, A through E, based on the order of identification. They found that compound E, which is later to be named cortisone, was found to be biologically active. Because compound E could be converted to androstenedione, a steroid ring-based chemical structure was confirmed. As I mentioned, we have all of Kendall's original lab books. It's a little hard to see, but that says E.C.K., Edward Kelvin Kendall, Book 1. And down at the bottom are the dates, January 31st, 1934 to October 7th, 1934. And you know this is a real notebook because it has the classic coffee mug sign. Reading these notebooks is pretty fascinating. It is written in a chemist's hand with chemist's language. But you can see even in these early pages the steroid ring structure that Kendall had sorted out. So now I'd like to just pause and review the pharmacologic history of corticosteroids. In May of 1941, a conference on adrenal hormones at Yale that Kendall attended, World War II was 2 years old, and it was becoming clear that the U.S. would soon be involved. At the conference, it was stated, based on rumors and whispers, that the German scientists had beaten all others in the race to unravel the secret of the adrenal cortex. They had made an adrenal extract that counteracted hypoxia and permitted their pilots to fly at 40,000 feet with impunity. It was also rumored that the German submarines were secretly shuttling bovine adrenals from Argentina to Germany. So this is the context of what was going on in 1941. So it shouldn't be surprising when you learn that the U.S. National Research Council, when they set the priorities, the research priorities for the World War II effort, number one, synthesize the active hormone from the adrenal cortex. Number two, produce penicillin. And number three, develop synthetic antimalarial agents. Fast forward to 1948. 14 years later, we're on lab notebook number 16. Compound E has been isolated, it's been tested, it's metabolically active, and finally, it's been synthesized. Recovery rates documented. Starting with ox bile, it took 30 steps to produce compound E. But World War II had come and gone. The stories on high altitude flying were unfounded. When the war ended, all the participants in the Adrenal Cortical Committee dropped out except for Mayo Clinic and Merck. A total of 9,000 milligrams of compound E had been synthesized for clinical study by the spring of 1948. 2,000 milligrams were given to each of three clinical investigators at Mayo for studies in patients with Addison's disease. The remaining 3,000 milligrams was saved for future study. Now I want to pause and introduce you to another player and another storyline that's key to the big story. Philip Showalter Hench. Hench had made the case for a substance X deficiency in rheumatoid arthritis. He was the first head of the section of rheumatic diseases at Mayo Clinic, and he suggested that compound E could be the factor deficient in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. This factor he referred to as substance X. Here's a publication from Hench, Effect of Spontaneous Jaundice on Rheumatoid Arthritis, Attempts to Reproduce the Phenomenon. Hench wrote, Nature possesses a highly effective method of producing dramatic remissions involving a phenomenon which is precipitated more rapidly by jaundice than any other physiological or therapeutic method. The next step belongs to the future. It is important for us to identify nature's dramatic, if accidental, antidote. And it's this antidote that Hench referred to as substance X. However, Hench gave patients multiple different liver-based concoctions, didn't affect rheumatoid arthritis at all. His research was very disappointing. He also wrote that over a period of 8 years, we studied the phenomena of pregnancy-induced remissions of rheumatoid arthritis as it developed 34 times in 20 women. So he showed that jaundice caused remission of rheumatoid arthritis and pregnancy caused remission in rheumatoid arthritis. He said, assuming that the unknown substance X of pregnancy was the same as that of jaundice, we began to suspect that the mysterious substance was neither a product of the liver nor a female hormone, but might be a steroid hormone common to both men and women. But what hormone and from what bisexual gland? So this is two typical Mayo Clinic consultants. A winter afternoon, feet on the radiator. Kendall wrote, each of us had a problem that was of top priority. His was to identify substance X, which he was convinced could reverse the usual pattern of progression of rheumatoid arthritis. Mine was to establish the value of cortical hormones in clinical medicine. So the question was, could compound E be the anti-rheumatic substance X? So it's time to introduce you to the patient, HG. She's a 28-year-old woman, previously evaluated at Mayo Clinic in February and May of 1948, for progressive inflammatory arthritis. This is a note from Slocum, Charles Slocum, February 24, 1948. He's a junior colleague of Hench. He wrote in her chart, have discussed, advised physio, contrast, more gold, iron, if not better, will be considered for jaundice. What he meant by that, bring her back to Mayo Clinic to induce jaundice to cause a remission in her arthritis. And she was no better. She returned to Mayo Clinic in July of 1948. She was hospitalized for 2 months for treatment with a Swedish hepatotoxin called lactoferrin. However, it didn't work for her. It didn't cause jaundice, something that happened in 40 to 50% of patients. Hench urged HG to return home. She refused. Searching for something to try, Hench was prompted to talk with Kendall. Kendall agreed to give Hench some of that remaining 3,000 milligrams of compound E if Hench could convince Merck and get their permission. On September 4th, 1948, Hench wrote a letter to Merck. It stretched the truth. He embellished similarities between patients with rheumatoid arthritis and Addison's disease. He wrote, "Clinically and histologically, from time to time, the adrenals have been incriminated." Probably very few times were they ever incriminated. "Chiefly because most rheumatoids tend to have a low blood pressure, are tired and weak, and many of them develop slight brownish pigmented spots on their skin." They were doing their best to try to make some kind of link between Addison's disease and rheumatoid arthritis to make this sound rational. Hench also speculated that based on the jaundice treatment trials, that the effects would become evident within a very few days, thus requiring very limited amounts of the precious compound E. Merck agreed to supply compound E for a treatment trial in one patient, HG. HG was hospitalized in the main hospital at Mayo Clinic, St. Mary's Hospital, room 127. She received her first dose of compound E on September 21st, 1948. Slocum wrote, "Compound E started today, 100 milligrams. Can hardly get out of bed. Walked only once." Day three. Slocum: "Feels much less muscle soreness this AM and feels stronger. Appetite good." HG says, "Breakfast almost a pleasure." Slocum: "Rolled over and turned off the radio with ease for the first time in weeks. No more trembling of the knees when moving." Could this be real? Could she actually be responding to compound E? Day four. Slocum: "Woke this morning, rolled over in bed easily, a thing she hadn't been able to do for months. When first seen, she was going through exercises, arms up over her head. Went to several patients to report her good progress. Today, joints also 50% better. Walks with only a slight limp. 3 days ago, couldn't walk." Day four, 7:30 p.m. Hench comes by. "The progression of relief in the last 48 hours is strikingly similar to that from jaundice, with muscle stiffness improving first, then joint stiffness, joint pain, and finally, resolution of swelling. If this is a real effect, and I not only want to think so, but inclined to think so, she should continue to have relief and be notably improved by Monday on the same dose." Day seven. Hench: "Patient certainly seems to have definite response. At this point, the patient makes the following remark, a masterpiece of understatement. Let us continue substance H, if possible, until patient's symptoms completely gone." Substance H? What happened to compound E? What could H stand for? Substance H was a temporary code name in an attempt to keep these initial findings confidential. Hench, Slocum, and Polly realized they were onto something. They were onto something big, and they didn't want the press to get a hold of this prematurely. Hench wrote on day seven, "On the cusp of what may be the most important discovery in pharmacotherapeutics of the century." What did Hench do? Day eight, he left for London for 3 months to deliver the Herberton Oration, which the title of which ironically was The Potential Reversibility of Rheumatoid Arthritis. So this project was left to his two junior faculty members, Slocum and Polly. Here's HG before treatment. And after 7 days of Compound E. It was dramatic. They started taking videos because they realized no one would believe them, that they actually had something that could affect, up until this point, of crippling disorder. Day 9, Slocum has had 8 days of 100 milligrams of H substance and 50 milligrams today. Went downtown shopping for 3 hours this p.m. Felt tired, but joints were good. Day 15, dose decreased to 25 milligrams per day. Put yourself in the shoes of Hench, Slocum, and Polly, seeing this miracle happen in front of your eyes. The fourth patient to be treated was a Mayo Clinic physician. During the first 24 days on Compound E, he experienced a comfortable wakefulness, and he finished writing 3 medical manuscripts that had been started over the previous 2 years and he'd been unable to complete. So while Hench was in London, Polly and Slocum took videos of the subsequent patients in the trial. This is Hench on the left. He's pushing on the joints as a way to demonstrate the tenderness of the joints before treatment. After 8 days of treatment, no pain. They truly were observing a miracle. So this is Hench and Kendall, Slocum and Polly. And they plotted out, what were they going to do from here? How were they going to convince the world that Compound E had a role in the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis? First, they had to come up with a name. Compound E was getting confused with vitamin E. So it was Hench that came up, based on corticosterone, with the name cortisone. Confirmatory studies. They decided they need to do some blinded studies where the examining physician didn't know if the patient was getting Compound E or placebo. And then they performed a multi-center study. They invited 5 experts for a week to Rochester: Walter Bauer from Harvard, Edward Rosenberg, Chicago, Paul Holbrook, Tucson, Edward Bolin, L.A., and Richard Freiberg, who was president of the American Rheumatism Association. Each center enrolled 2 patients. So a 5-center study, 2 patients each. The treatment protocols also included ACTH. So here is a Compound E protocol and a cholesterol control. This is 2 days before treatment with Compound E. That right there was called the Hench Quench. And some of these patients look like they're ready to punch Hench. After 8 days of treatment, and then she's given cholesterol for 17 days. He's asking her, does this hurt? And now ACTH injection. It wasn't clear to them if ACTH would have the same effect. They wondered if somehow rheumatoid arthritis was related to disordered adrenal production of cortisone, and giving ACTH actually might make a patient worse. This is after 11 days of ACTH. So on that photo I showed you of the four individuals, you can see in the background, here's a graph on the chalkboard. This is time and days, and this is erythrocyte sedimentation rate. They had very few biomarkers of inflammation, but one was the erythrocyte sedimentation rate. You can see ACTH is drawn here, administered here, and the sed rate drops as time goes on. So they planned a presentation April 20th at the regular weekly Wednesday scientific meeting of the Mayo Clinic staff. Here's that evening, and you can see there's Kendall at the podium. In his memoirs, Kendall wrote, "It was a memorable meeting. Every member of the staff of Mayo Clinic was present. Every seat in Plummer Hall was taken, and chairs were placed in the aisles. But many sat on the windowsills, even out to the elevators. Everyone is filled with anticipation and enthusiasm. Seldom has such an advance in clinical medicine been made known under more auspicious circumstances." A week earlier, a Mayo Clinic rheumatology trainee was interviewing for a job in New York City. He was asked by Dr. Howard Rusk, "When is Mayo's new arthritis discovery going to be announced?" He told him about this upcoming staff meeting next week. Turns out Rusk was an associate editor at the New York Times. So he told his science editor, William Lawrence, that there was going to be a breakthrough announced the evening of April 20th, 1949, in Rochester, Minnesota. Lawrence showed up uninvited. He attended the Mayo staff meeting and published a front-page article in the New York Times the next day, April 21st, 1949. Aid in rheumatoid arthritis was promised by new hormone. Preliminary tests during the last 7 months at the Mayo Clinic with a hormone from the skin of the adrenal glands has opened up an entirely new approach to the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis, the most painful form of arthritis that cripples millions. It was revealed here tonight. And two reports by members of the Mayo staff illustrated the motion pictures that there was presented to a distinguished gathering of physicians, physiologists, chemists, the first word on what may become the great landmark in medicine, comparable to the discovery of insulin and penicillin. On the screen, the gathering saw 14 men and women, some bedridden, some in wheelchairs, stiff of joint, ridden with pain, get up and walk briskly up and down like normal human beings. They saw a woman who was barely able to walk, run friskly up and down a series of steps. They saw a man, a physician, whose joints were so painful that he reacted with agonizing pain to being touched, improve after a few treatments to the point where he could dance a jig. These early results, therefore, indicate that rheumatoid arthritis and possibly other chronic crippling diseases may be due to a deficiency in a hormone, and the treatment would not lead to a permanent cure, but would have to be taken regularly in the same manner as insulin is taken to control diabetes. A chain reaction occurred throughout the lay press. Data were promptly presented that May at the annual meeting of the Association of American Physicians, and subsequently in June, the International Congress of Rheumatology, where that multi-center study with 10 patients was presented. And it was here that the word cortisone was first used. Subsequent articles in New York Times were published, all by William Lawrence. This article was about on the cost of cortisone, $60 for 300 milligrams. $60 in 1949 is $610 in 2017 dollars. And the fact that a kilogram of cortisone, back then $200,000, that'd be over $2 million today. By weight, cortisone was 53-4 more valuable than gold. People were coming from around the world to Rochester, Minnesota to get cortisone. Merck started commercial production of cortisone in 1949. By May of 1951, Kendall received the 1 millionth gram from 1,000 kilograms of cortisone synthesized for medical use. This is a telegram that Philip Hench received October 26, 1950, informing him that he, Edward Kendall, Professor Thaddeus Reichstein, won the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine for their discoveries regarding the hormones of the adrenal cortex, their structure, and biologic effects. The word spread fast and was front page news around the globe. Nobel Prize Physiology and Medicine was awarded in December 1950 to Kendall, Hench, and Reichstein, just 27 months after HG received her very first dose of Compound E. 67 years later, corticosteroids are used for their anti-inflammatory immunosuppressive properties across the field of medicine. Natural cortisone, cortisol, and synthetic glucocorticoids have been employed to manage a wide variety of non-adrenal conditions, allergic disorders, dermatologic disorders, other endocrine disorders, ophthalmologic diseases, gastrointestinal diseases, hematologic disorders, infectious diseases, neoplastic disorders, neurologic disorders, pulmonary disorders, rheumatology, transplant medicine, and a big miscellaneous category. Of all of us in this room, I suspect there are very few that have not been exposed to some corticosteroid, topical corticosteroid for a rash, inhaled for asthma, injected for joint pain, or taken orally for an inflammatory disorder. Compound E was truly a miracle drug. Just as with thyroxine in 1914, it was decided by Mayo Clinic leadership to not benefit financially from the royalties derived from the patents. Kendall wrote, "I expressed the belief that no member of the staff should profit from patents issued for work carried out in the laboratories of Mayo Clinic." But there's more to the story, and with that, I will conclude the presentation. What happened to the patient, HG? She had 100 milligrams for 8 days, 50 milligrams for 5 days, 25 milligrams for 9 days. On day 20, Kemper wrote, "Patient discouraged. She had 25 milligrams H substance at 10:30 a.m. Following this, she noted some improvement. The improvement persisted until 4 p.m. Since then, she's noticed rather rapid increase in symptoms. Days 20 to 50, dose and drug adjustments. October 19th, 50 milligrams at 9:30 a.m. and 4:55 p.m. Day 54, Kemper. Mark Thirst has gained 2.5 pounds in 3 days. Face more full. Days 66 to 178, further dose adjustments. Polly wrote, PSH, that's Philip Showalter Hench, thinks still 50% less arthritic than before treatment, but it's hard to determine because this is something different. Disability is now different. She's bedridden. Shape of face is different. Has more fuzz. Acne worse. Weakness, amenorrhea, osteoporosis, prominent factors. She prefers arthritis to what I have now. Cry, nervous, can't concentrate, depressed, never so absent-minded. Just feel weaker and weaker every day. This is HG's appearance, August 1948, December 1948, and with iatrogenic Cushing's, March 1949, when she declined continued treatment with cortisone. Kendall later wrote, "Cortisone and its derivatives are a two-edged sword. When they're administered in large doses over long periods of time, symptoms of hypercortisolism appear." Day 237, on May 10, 1949, HG was dismissed from St. Mary's Hospital. 6 months after dismissal, there was communication. She'd been gradually improving. She remained in bed continuously during the summer and fall. She has much less hair on her face and much less fullness in her face. The acne is almost gone. 2 years following dismissal, systemic lupus erythematosus is diagnosed based on vasculitis, a malar rash, and LE cells. She refused cortisone treatment, but accepted treatment with ACTH. 5 years following dismissal, she died with symptoms consistent with CNS vasculitis and pulmonary edema. What about the chemist? What happened to Kendall? 1971, Kendall reflected on that presentation to the Mayo Clinic staff the evening of April 20th, 1949. As I walked to the speaker's desk after these two superlative presentations, I had a strong inclination to say simply that anything I could add would be an anticlimax and sit down. As a spokesman for all those who devoted many years to this problem, I was determined to make it clear that pure research in biochemistry sometimes can supply a vital link for use by the clinician. Due to the mandatory age 65 retirement rules at Mayo Clinic, Kendall retired a year after his Nobel Prize, 1951. He took a visiting professorship at the James Forrestal Research Center at Princeton. It had become clear that cortisone did not cure rheumatoid arthritis or other inflammatory disorders, but it would keep them in check. But when given in high doses, cortisone caused iatrogenic Cushing's syndrome. So at Princeton, Kendall set out to find what we would call today a selective glucocorticoid receptor modulator, where the anti-inflammatory effects could be isolated from the catabolic effects. And as you all know, he did not find that modulator. In May of 1972, Kendall was on a consulting trip to Merck, and while writing a formula on the blackboard, he became suddenly ill. He died of cardiac failure 3 days later, May 4, 1972, at age 86 years. Kendall wrote about the driving force behind medical research. But two components of the drive can be understood and are appreciated by almost everyone. These are a love of whatever things are true and a desire to create something. The scientist hopes to discover a small addition to the accumulated truth of the ages and to create procedures that make this revelation available to all. These hopes constitute a powerful drive that's an inexhaustible source of strength. This is a story of discovery science, clinical intuition, persistence and teamwork, patient volunteerism and sacrifice, and hopes and dreams. And I want to thank you all today for sharing this story with me.